You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture. I'm Jasmin Shamsuddin, and there has been considerable recent interest in the cognitive style of individuals with autism spectrum disorder. The severity of ASD varies from individual to individual, and many children with ASD may experience delays in their cognitive development. It's been estimated that around 70% of children with ASD also have some degree of cognitive delay. With us this afternoon are Dr. Elizabeth Shepherd, a first-class honors Oxford graduate who is currently doing internationally significant and acclaimed research into autism, and Dr. Peter Mitchell, the chief editor of the British Journal of Psychology. Welcome both of you to the show this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
This is the first time we've had you on, Elizabeth, so welcome. Elizabeth, why is the proportion of cases of autism with cognitive delay decreasing?
Well, it's true that the proportion of cases with cognitive delay is decreasing, but this is in a general context of an overall increase in the number of cases being diagnosed with autism. And this is specifically because of advances in diagnostic methods and our ability to identify cases of autism, and particularly a greater appreciation that there are many cases of autism that are in individuals who are very high functioning. But it's important to note that whilst these people may be academically quite able, they still have severe difficulties associated with their particular autistic profile.
Okay, so can you name a couple of these difficulties? Just to sample a few.
Well, in addition to a general kind of cognitive delay, there are various cognitive tendencies which we're going to talk about this afternoon. But these difficulties occur in both social and non-social areas of functioning. So some researchers have suggested that they have difficulties in processing social stimuli, so other people. They might have difficulty inferring emotional states of other people, in predicting their behavior based on their beliefs or their intentions. In the non-social domain, it's been found that they are often relatively unaffected by context. So typical individuals tend to process events quite globally or holistically, and tend to interpret them based on the context in which they occur. But people with autism perhaps focus a bit more on isolated instances without being able to use the context to help them make sense of things.
Okay. Now, I guess that's how autism impacts a person's cognitive functioning, doesn't it?
It does. Elizabeth's giving a very clear and detailed answer on some of the features of autism. But if I might just add to that, we can see how autism impacts on a person's cognitive style when we're actually measuring intelligence. So in a typical IQ test, like the Wechsler scales for intelligence, we're measuring performance IQ and we're measuring verbal IQ. So we're measuring verbal abilities and we're measuring non-verbal abilities. And the test is designed such that for people, most people, people without autism, we see a similar level of functioning in the verbal domain and in the performance domain. But in autism, we see a very different pattern. We see very poor ability typically in the verbal domain, but we see spared functioning or even heightened functioning in the performance domain. So people with autism are not really so effective generally in verbal skills, but they can be very effective in understanding the world visually.
I see. Okay, that's very interesting. Now, in addition to general cognitive delay, children with autism spectrum disorder also often display other unique cognitive tendencies. Can you kindly elaborate on what those are?
As we've just mentioned, they show a good performance in the visual domain.
What does that mean in layman's English?
So, they tend to be visual learners. Mm-hmm. They can have a good memory for information if it's presented in a visual format. They're often actually much better able to learn information if it's written down than if it's spoken to them or presented in some kind of other way.
Right, okay. I heard that children with ASD tend to be overselective. What does this refer to?
We can see many examples of this. People with autism are characterized by a narrowing of interests. And on certain levels, we can see examples of this, such as, imagine that there's you dropped a single grain of rice on the carpet, and it would be terrifically difficult for you to spot where it is. But famously, many people with autism can just look at the carpet and spot it immediately. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we see in autism, in some cases of autism, is perfect pitch. Perfect pitch. So people with autism, in some cases, are extremely accurate in judging sounds, in processing auditory information in very fine and precise detail. And I'm reminded of one particular example of back in England a few years ago. I had occasion to visit the local park, actually with an autistic child. The boy was aged, I think, 4 or 5 years. We went into the park, and it was very peaceful, very pleasant sunny day in England. I know that's unusual for England, but it was actually a very pleasant summer's day. And the park was quiet and peaceful, and yet this boy put his hands over his head and said, "I can't stand the noise." And I said, "I can't hear any noise. What are you talking about?" And he said, "The bird's singing."
Oh.
Now, I could, well, once he mentioned it, I could start to, you know, hear the bird singing. But for him, it was such an intense noise that he had to cover his ears. So we see examples of some children and some individuals with autism being very acutely aware of details, sometimes even painfully aware of visual information or of sounds, and this is a characteristic of the overselective style of processing that we see in autism.
Would this have anything to do with, I don't know if you can call it a condition, but you know, there are labels that we give our children, and highly sensitive child is a label that I've seen bandied around on the internet in parenting forums.
I'm glad you've mentioned that, because one thing that we all need to understand is that autism, arguably, is part of a continuum, which means that people with autism, more able people with autism, are shading or grading into the performance of the general population. So we see a grading from the general population into the autistic spectrum. That's what we tend to see. Now, one might say that a child who is highly sensitive or oversensitive, I mean, that doesn't mean for 1 minute that they might have autism. It doesn't mean that. But they might be heading in this overall distribution towards the autistic side of things. I mean, it doesn't mean to say they're autistic,
right,
but it might be they have some features that are heading in that direction.
Right. Should you be concerned as a parent? No?
No, absolutely not. Because what we see in autism are characteristics that we see in everybody, really. It's just that they're in an extreme form. And when we see a constellation of characteristics, a combination together, such as poor verbal ability, poor socialization, poor imagination, then at some point this might warrant being seen by a clinician, and in extreme case might even warrant a diagnosis of autism. But we see autistic features in everybody in the population. It's just when we see a certain combination of features in people with autism and of such severity that under those circumstances we might say that it's time to bring in a clinician.
Okay. Another cognitive tendency in children with autism is the concrete processing of information. For example, you say it's raining cats and dogs. Will it interpreted literally by a child with autism as, you know, raining cats and dogs? Why does this happen?
Well, this does happen, and there are many examples of situations where children with autism tend to take things over literally. The classic example is the situation at the dinner table when somebody says to a child with autism, "Can you pass me the salt?" And they say yes, and then do nothing because they answer the question quite literally. And this is, I think, part of a more general difficulty with understanding the intended right. meaning.
So you would say to a child like this, please pass me the salt now.
Something like that. Yeah. You may have to actually adapt the way that you speak to them to clarify or make clear what you actually intend them to do, because they can take things very literally. And it's thought that this is all tied up with their difficulty that they have understanding other people's beliefs and intentions, which prevents them from considering these potential interpretations of what the person's saying to them. You can also see this as another case of them failing to take context into mm-hmm. account. So in order to understand the non-literal or metaphorical meaning, you have to think about what is being said in the context of a conversation as a whole. And if you don't have that kind of shared appreciation of your conversation, then you can't interpret utterances like this.
Okay, very interesting. In case you have just joined us, we are, of course, speaking about cognitive aspects of autism with Dr. Elizabeth Shepherd and Dr. Peter Mitchell. If you do have any questions, we'll ask those at the end of the show. You can send those via SMS to 016-2019-1000. And I understand as well, a strong aptitude for rote memory is another typical cognitive tendency among children with ASD. We'll find out a little bit more about that and how parents can tap onto this strength here on BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
This is The Bigger Picture. I'm Shazmin Shamsuddin, and we're talking today about the cognitive aspects of autism with Dr. Elizabeth Shepherd and Dr. Peter Mitchell. And I've read that a strong aptitude for rote memory is a typical cognitive tendency among children with ASD, autism spectrum disorder. How could parents tap on to this strength?
I think this is a very, very good question. And the reason why I think it's a good question is because traditionally educators and perhaps parents have been asking themselves, how can we change this child so this child becomes a normal child? That's often what they're asking themselves. Yeah. And the training that they're doing, their education they're doing, is the purpose is aimed at that outcome. How can we make the child into a normal child? Now, another way of handling people with autism and educating people with autism is to say, well, people with autism have a range of strengths and a range of weaknesses. Now, we need to work on the weaknesses to help them to improve, of course we do. But another consideration is that in terms of their strengths, how can we build upon those strengths? How can we exploit those strengths and help them to improve, help them to learn, help them to develop in the context of the strengths that they already have? Now, one of the strengths that we see in people with autism is a capacity for learning information, maybe by rote learning, but learning lots of detailed information. Examples of this are we see some children with autism who are quite outstanding at some numerical skills or arithmetical skills. We see instances of children who are excellent at understanding calendars and understanding dates as well. We see instances of children who are quite brilliant at understanding visual information and at drawing ability. So we see various instances of abilities like this. And the question is, how can parents build upon those strengths to help them to educate to their full potential? That's the question. Now, I think in answer to that question, what we need to recognize is that it's not necessarily going to be very effective to use verbal techniques, because that's not a strength in autism. What we need to do is recognize that people with autism have special interests to some degree, to allow them to concentrate on that special interest, perhaps, to develop some expertise in that area that they're interested in, and in particular, to use visual information. And then perhaps you can help to develop expertise in things like draftsmanship. That's a skill, that's an area of study where you need great visual ability, and you also need great ability in understanding pictorial information. So these are all instances of how we can tap into this ability that we see in autism to make them become stronger in their education and in their intellectual development.
Right. I'm sorry if I've been distracting you with my choking here. I have a fit of coughing. Okay, so how does autism impact a person's capacity to learn in a more typical and fully able way?
Well, as Peter just mentioned, they do have this different learning style that's more visual, usually, and less verbal. They also tend to prefer concrete information rather than abstract information. And this may mean that they'll be very good at some subjects but poor as others. But there are a number of other ways in which autism can also more indirectly impact on their ability to learn. For example, it can have a big impact on their behaviour in an educational setting. So some kids with ASD may be very able, but they might just simply not understand the importance of learning some certain things. And so it can be very challenging to get a child with ASD to learn anything if he or she chooses not to. Another problem they may have is with subjects that require a great deal of social interaction. So they tend to have very high anxiety in social situations, and this might make it difficult for them to perform well in subjects where it's necessary to discuss information with others or where they have to be involved in active teamwork.
I see. Okay. Children with autism are extremely intelligent, but would an IQ test be a gauge of an autistic child's intelligence, the average IQ test, the one that we see?
We certainly use IQ tests with people with autism, and they are able, if they're higher functioning people, they can follow the questions, they can follow the tasks that are presented by an IQ test. An IQ test is very useful in the context of autism because it can reveal to us that one of the characteristics of autism is spared ability in the performance domain of intelligence, but perhaps a delay or an impairment in the verbal domain of intelligence, which is an uneven intellectual profile that's absolutely characteristic and typical of people with autism. Now, it is the case that some individuals with autism are quite intelligent, and there's no doubt about that. And we can say that because we can see measured intelligence above average in some people with autism. And we can say it because we can see some of our colleagues, we can see some of our students who are doing, for example, a BSc in science with an official diagnosis, a formal diagnosis of autism. We can see it in some PhD students who are studying for a doctorate with a formal diagnosis of autism. And indeed, we see that some of our colleagues who are working as university professors, I certainly know of some in the UK, mm-hmm. who have an official diagnosis of autism. So these are individuals who are quite handicapped by this condition and are not able to function in many areas of life, but they're very, very smart, and they can have a great career, earn a great salary, and in many ways gain a great deal of satisfaction out of the work that they're doing. But they still have this impairment or impediment that makes it difficult for them to connect with people, and perhaps there's something lacking, let's say, in their social life that can be quite serious in some cases. Incidentally, we see an alarmingly high rate of suicide in adolescents with Asperger syndrome, which is a higher functioning form of autism, because these individuals are denied opportunities to connect with other people by their condition and are feeling quite desperate and lonely because of that, and they can become depressed, and in extreme cases we do see instances of suicide. So it's extremely serious.
Right.
Now, in terms of the question of is an IQ test a suitable measure for intelligence? In my view, generally, it is. But having said that, for some people with autism, there are aspects of autism that make formal tasks or formal tests a bit daunting for them. They tend to become quite anxious by these things. And moreover, the test has a fair amount of, or some parts of it have a fair amount of verbal material in it, which they're not comfortable with. So arguably, some parts of the test might underestimate their ability. But the striking thing about autism is not that they're performing badly on the test. In some parts of the test, they often perform very well, and that really is quite remarkable.
Right. Is it difficult, though, to help people with autism who may have these cognitive problems?
It's a major challenge. It's certainly difficult to help them, and I'm involved in doing autism research, and I can really only commend people who work in the more applied or clinical areas to help people with autism lead more fulfilling lives, such as the National Autistic Society here in Malaysia, who are doing a lot of work to do this kind of thing. I would say that it's difficult to help them, but it's not impossible. Early intervention is very important, so we need to identify people with autism at the age of 2 or 3 when the first signs start to be shown, and to make sure that they go into the right kind of intervention program. So in some cases, this might be going into special educational provision. In other cases, they may be able to be educated in the mainstream with the right kind of support. But in both cases, these programs will, as we've mentioned before, build on their strengths and train the individual to manage their autism. It's also, we can help them by doing research, by trying to find out more about what these core difficulties are that they have. At the moment, we're still gathering information about this, and until we have a clear characterization of all the problems they have, it's going to be difficult to devise treatments.
Okay. A question here from Kumar. Has any research been done to find out what causes autism? Is it hereditary? Is it linked to, I think we covered this in the last conversation we had on autism. Is it linked to vaccines?
Well, I'd be happy to answer that question. And autism has an heritability of around about 80%. And indeed, in the rare cases where we see identical twins, so these are twins who are genetically identical, if one of them is diagnosed with autism, then the probability that the other twin will also have autism is around about 80%. So the genetic factor in autism, I mean, not just based on that, but based on other evidence as well, is around about 80%. Now, in terms of the question of how autism is related to vaccine, a study was published on this quite a few years ago now by somebody called Dr. Andrew Schofield in the UK, who's a general practitioner. And he found that a few parents visited his clinic saying that, well, my child seemed to be developing quite normally, and then the child had the MMR jab, the MMR vaccine, mumps, measles and rubella, the triple vaccine. And after that, the child started to withdraw and started not to be very good at connecting, not smiling to face, not making eye contact. And that led Dr. Schofield to go ahead and do a study looking at the relationship between children having this vaccine and whether they subsequently developed autistic features. And from his study, he said that there was a positive result, that there was evidence of such a relationship. Now, that finding had great repercussions, and a lot of researchers then went out to try to find out if this could be replicated. And the simple answer to this question is it cannot be replicated. It is not a genuine finding. It is not a reliable finding. So then that might lead us to ask then, why did these parents report to Dr. Schofield that there seemed to be a link between the child who was apparently developing normally, then having the MMR jab, and then starting to show autistic mm-hmm. features? How does that happen? Well, I think the answer to that question is this, that autism, almost certainly is a disorder that's present with us from birth. Indeed, it's almost certainly transmitted to us through our genes. That's almost certainly the case. But even though it's innate, even though it's genetic, that doesn't mean to say it shows itself from the outset. It doesn't show necessarily show itself in a 3-month-old baby or a 6-month-old baby. So when does autism start to present itself? And the answer is almost certainly beyond the age of 1 year, maybe at 2 years. It's going to be later in development when it starts to show itself. And coincidentally, and it is just a coincidence, that's about the same time when the baby has this vaccine, this MMR injection. So I think there's just this is just coincidence. I don't think that vaccines have anything whatsoever to do with autism. No, it's something that's genetic.
Well, thank you for clearing that up. Why do some people with autism then have special abilities? How is autism linked with genius?
People with autism have an aptitude, a natural aptitude, for understanding the world visually. As we've already discussed, mm-hmm. we see this uneven intellectual profile. We see heightened ability in the visual domain of functioning, but a weakened ability in the verbal domain of functioning. So we see this natural ability, and we also see a tendency in autism to develop a special interest, to narrowly focus on a particular area that interests them and then pursue it to the exclusion of everything else. Now, supposing that you have considerable intellectual potential, which most of us do, and supposing you just channel it into one narrow area of functioning, at some point you're going to develop into an expert. Mm-hmm. You will develop into an expert. And some people who have high ability are probably, or possibly, going to develop into a genius in that area of functioning. Now, throughout history, I suspect we can see people who might fall into this category. And, of course, I'm speculating because the people I'm going to talk about were never seen by a clinician, to my knowledge, mm-hmm. and were never diagnosed with autism. But if we look at people like Isaac Newton, if we look at some of the details of the character, I don't mean the science, I don't mean that he invented a theory of gravity, I'm talking about some of the information we have about the way he interacted with people and the way he led his life. Well, it sounds as though he had some autistic features, and perhaps he had this narrowing of interest, in this case on physics and mathematics, that led him to be the greatest genius in the history of humanity, at least in the domain mm-hmm. of physics. Another example, well, I mean, some people speculate that maybe Einstein had autism as well, but a less known example, and this is my opinion actually, but a less known example would be somebody called Alan Turing. Have you ever heard of Alan Turing?
Of course you haven't.
Well, Alan Turing was a British genius who invented the world's first computer. He's credited with inventing the first computer, and he invented it in the 1940s. And the reason why he invented it was because this was in World War II, and the Nazis, who were trying to occupy Britain at this time, were trying to strangle Britain by sending out fleets of U-boats that were sinking convoys coming from the USA to Britain to supply arms and supply food mm-hmm. and various other materials, and the U-boats were sinking the ships. And importantly, the Nazis were sending encrypted messages to the U-boats, giving them information, all sorts of information. And it was such a clever encryption that the British couldn't read this message. It was a system called Enigma, I think. And so the British Secret Service tasked the most brilliant man in the country with cracking these codes, and that man was Alan Turing. And the authorities, the Secret Service, thought that he's such a brilliant mathematician that he'll get a piece of paper, work it all out, and then come up with the answer. But Turing was so smart that he realized that this is beyond human capacity, and what's needed is a kind of electronic brain that could solve this problem. Mm-hmm. And then he set about building a computer to do this, and within an incredibly short period of time, he had constructed this computer called Colossus. And it was made out of parts of an old telephone exchange. I've actually seen this working. It's in near Milton Keynes, in a place called Bletchley Park. You can still see it working. It still works. I mean, it has these old vacuum valves. You know, you can see them lighting up as it's, you see them glowing as it's doing the calculations. And this machine was able to crack the code of Enigma, and then so the messages that the Nazis were sending suddenly became transparent to the British. And for that reason, the British survived. And if Turing had not done that, mm-hmm. we would probably now be holding this conversation in German.
Probably. So, I mean, from, I suppose, looking at his case, I mean, in a social context, what was he like?
He was a disaster.
He was a disaster.
He was an absolute disaster. I mean, he had no ability to communicate with people. He was completely egocentric, just mm-hmm. living in his own world. So he was an absolute disaster.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Now, what can research on drawing tell us about autism?
Well, drawing or artistry is one of the main areas in which savant skills can occur. And we carried out some research back in the UK to try and find out a bit more about what it is about the perceptual skills of people with autism that enable this kind of savant abilities to develop. So the research that we used, that we carried out, used copying task, and for this we tested some children with autism. They weren't savants, they had fairly normal drawing ability, but we wanted to see if there was anything unusual about the way that they tackled this kind of task. And we found that when we compared them with children of the same age who didn't have a diagnosis of autism, the children with autism were superior at copying line drawings of three-dimensional objects. So they seem to be particularly good at depicting the three-dimensional properties of objects, things like a cube or a cylinder. And the way that we interpreted this was that we think that this is because when typical children draw, they tend to base their drawings a lot upon their knowledge about the properties of objects. So rather than just focusing on what they can actually see, they have perceptions that are almost contaminated right. by what they know to be out there in the world. So when we perceive things, we don't perceive what's really there necessarily. Our perception of the world is an interpretation that we make of it. And perhaps it's the case that children with autism, because they tend to perceive the world in a more kind of literal manner, this actually enables them to develop these very good drawing skills if coupled with,
right.
you know...
I guess what you're saying is a regular child would see a drawing of a three-dimensional cube and think, well, it's on a two-dimensional piece of paper, so, you know, they can't really quite grasp and copy that, whereas an autistic child may really literally just copy what they see.
If you ask a typical 7-year-old to copy a line drawing of a cube, they will draw a series of squares on the mm-hmm. page because they know that each of the faces is really a square shape. They are unable to overcome their knowledge about what it really is like and
right.
focus on what they see in front of them.
Okay, let's talk about eye tracking. What is it and how can we use eye tracking to make discoveries about autism?
Eye tracking, well, in our laboratory, we use an eye tracker called a Tobii system. And it looks like, and indeed is, a computer screen. It looks like that computer screen you have on the desk over there, in fact. And it has four tiny sensors in each of the four corners, such that as you're looking at the screen, as you're reading information, or as your attention is captured by anything anywhere on that screen, these sensors can detect exactly, they can detect precisely where you're looking. Even if you're reading text, the eye tracker is able to tell us which part of the word are you fixating on as you're scrolling through and reading that text. Mm-hmm. It's so precise. Quite a remarkable instrument. The Tobii system that we use in our laboratory cost around about $40,000. So even though it just looks like a regular computer screen, that's effectively what it is. It's actually a very high quality piece of equipment. So, you know, we had a decision to make. Do we buy a Toyota Camry or do we buy this eye tracker?
Right.
Okay, well, we bought the eye tracker because it tells us very, very useful and important information about how people with autism process the world. So imagine that on the screen we presented a scene of a person. Let's say there's a person in this scene, and we might want to know whether people with autism look at the person, or do they look at physical objects? If they look at the person, do they look at the person's face? Do they look at the person's eyes? Because clinical reports say that people with autism are not very effective at looking at the face, that they're not very effective at looking at the eyes, and moreover, that people with autism are not very effective at following the direction of another person's gaze. Now, this is a really important human skill, and it's a skill that we see from about the age of 12 to 18 months. Namely, if you're engaging with a toddler, you're talking, or you're trying to capture the attention of a normal toddler, let's say, and then you suddenly switch your direction of gaze and start to look somewhere else, then it's absolutely natural for that toddler to follow your direction of gaze and look to the same place. They do it quite naturally. It's a natural human ability. And some people have speculated that people with autism are not able to do that. But it's never been tested systematically. And so for the first time with this Tobii eye tracker, we were able to find out, do people with autism follow other people's gaze direction? Do they even look at the face? What we found was that over a 5-second viewing of a social scene, in other words, a picture of a room with a person in it, that the amount of time over these 5 seconds that a person with autism looks at the face and looks at the eyes is exactly the same as the amount of time this normal person spends. And moreover, that just as having looked at the face, a normal person will look at the face and then follow gaze direction to follow that person's eyes to a physical object. And so people with autism did exactly the same. And that was terrifically surprising to us. And so then the question arises is into what way are people with autism different? And actually, they are different in a very subtle way. The difference was that when you show this scene to clinically normal people, they immediately look to the person, they immediately look to the face, and then they very quickly follow gaze direction. But the participants with autism immediately look to physical objects, and then belatedly they start to look to the face. But having looked at the face, they still follow gaze direction. Mm-hmm. So in summary, it seems to be the case that people with autism prioritize physical aspects of the scene. That's what naturally captures their attention, whereas normal people, clinically normal people, what naturally captures their attention is social aspects of the scene, like people, faces. So they're doing the same thing, really. It's just that the order of priority is different.
I see. Okay. Can people with autism live independently, Elizabeth?
I think this is a good question, because so much of the time we talk about children with autism, and it's easy to forget that children with autism do become adults with autism. It's a lifelong condition. And one of the key goals that one might have for people with autism is that they can live as independently as possible. The answer is that in some cases, yes, they can. But they do have a lot of problems with negotiating the practicalities of life. They have difficulties with things like planning their time, multitasking, and also managing anxiety levels. So in most cases, some specific training is required to help them to complete goal-directed tasks. And these are all important steps towards achieving their independence.
Okay, what about driving? Can someone with autism drive? And what potential problems could they face? We take driving for granted, don't we?
Very, very much so. It's really, really something that's essential, and particularly in Malaysia, I think. It's hard to imagine being able to survive without a car. People with autism are allowed to drive, and some of them apply for licenses, and some of them do successfully obtain driving licenses, but it seems to be something that they find very difficult. And this is something that we've been doing some research on recently. So far there's been no research into this particular area, so we've started doing some studies on this, and there are probably a number of aspects of driving that could be problematic for people with autism. But one of the main features that we thought might be problematic is to do with the fact that driving itself involves quite a lot of social interaction. So, for example, when you're driving along, you might have to look at and predict what a pedestrian's going to do. So are they going to step into the road? Mm-hmm. You have to monitor a lot of other people's intentions, what other drivers are going to do, whether they're going to try and overtake you or whatever. So if people with autism do have these problems understanding and predicting other people's behaviour, would this cause problems for them on the roads? So the way that we investigated this was we asked people with and without autism to watch videos of road scenes. And these videos were filmed from the point of view of a driver in a car. And they had to respond as quickly as they could by pressing a button if they could see a hazard developing on the road. So a hazard would be something like a pedestrian stepping into the road. It could be a car pulling out from a junction. Any of these kind of events that happen that are unexpected and dangerous. And what we found was that people with autism were able to identify driving hazards, but they were significantly slower than typical individuals. And they also seem to have a particular difficulty if the source of the hazard was a person.
Okay, so if it was an object like a car pulling out.
Exactly, if it was an object or another vehicle, they seemed to be much more able to identify them than if it was a person. So it's good news that they are able to identify them, but they did have some difficulties. So this makes a case for there possibly being a need for some kind of special training to assist them in areas like this.
Okay. Well, any final words on the subject today, Peter?
Yes.
Yes, wow.
Indeed.
This was a long interview, but very interesting, yes.
Well, did you by any chance watch the BBC World News this morning? Because on the BBC World News, we saw brain images of people with autism that have recently been published in the Journal of Neuroscience by somebody called Professor Declan Murphy from London University. And he's saying that we can see some differences on these scans using MRI technology in people with autism compared with people who do not have autism. And so this is a really very exciting discovery, and it's extremely promising. This is just the start of it. You know, this is just the early stage. But what we're planning to do in our laboratory is use similar neuroscience techniques to try to get some information about the way the brain works in people with autism. We're going to use an electroencephalogram, EEG, and this system is a net of electrodes that the person wears on their head, and these tiny electrodes can pick up minute amounts of electromagnetic activity that's been generated by the cortex of the brain. And what this system is very good at doing is registering when the cortex of the brain has or when somebody's attended to information. Now, according to our eye tracking studies, we think that people with autism are a little bit slower than people without autism in attending to social information. What we're going to do in the next stage, our plan, is to use the EEG, the electroencephalogram, to see if we can detect these differences in the priority of processing in autism at the level of the cortex of the brain. And once we can do that, once we know the answer to this, we will have the kind of technology that's needed, the kind of techniques that are needed to be able to diagnose autism at a very, very early stage. Because if we can detect something different in autism at the level of the cortex, and if it's innate, in other words, if it's transmitted to us through our genes, then we can probably detect these differences at a very, very early age. And we can use the EEG technology with infants as well. So that holds up the promise at some point in the future of doing very early diagnosis using neuroscience technology. And the earlier we can diagnose autism, the earlier we can start to make a change in how we relate to people with autism and the kind of education that we offer to people with autism that will give them the best possible chance to exploit the skills that they have and also to be able to connect socially with other people. So that's our aim, that's our objective, that's what we want to do.
That sounds exciting. Well, good luck with that.
And thank you
for joining us today on The Bigger Picture.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
Of course, that was Dr. Peter Mitchell, who is the chief editor of the British Journal of Psychology, and Dr. Elizabeth Shepherd, a first-class honors Oxford graduate, currently doing internationally significant and acclaimed research into autism. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.